Professors FM.
Hey, welcome everyone. Welcome to the Fanalytics Podcast, brought to you by the Emory Marketing Analytics Center. My name is Mike Lewis. I'm joined by Mr. Doug Battle. Doug, it is the greatest tournament in all of sports. We've talked about this over the years.
Oh, yeah.
The NCAA basketball tournament, the greatest tournament in all of sports. 68 teams get to participate, so it's sort of democratic. It's one and done, so you've got a bunch of randomness. There's this idea of the Cinderella, sort of the small brands taking on the big brands, the blue bloods. It has literally everything, and it even has a format that allows for, you know, 2-3 weeks of intense gambling activity to take place in the workplace with all sorts of trash talking, you know, and mockery going on. It is the greatest tournament in all of sports.
It's the greatest tournament in sports. You mentioned gambling. I don't know if it's the best time of year to be a gambler. I saw a number of games, and I'll try to pull video for this for social, where a team beat the cover or beat the spread on a buzzer beater. Still lost the game, but there was one from Damian Lillard range at the end of at the end of a game, and bettors are losing their minds. That's a kind of a funny element of all of this. But yeah, I mean, the first two rounds gave us everything. We had a 16 seed beating a 1 seed for the second time ever. We've got Princeton making continuing to dance into the Sweet 16. Florida Atlantic's kind of the other smaller school in the mix still. They were a 9 seed, but, you know, with a potentially a winnable game coming up against Tennessee, I got some numbers from our new Fanalytics analyst, Emory student Adrian.
Intern.
And Florida Atlantic, that's a team that, you know, they went 34-3 in the regular season. I always keep an eye on those teams that are like 30 wins and above in a smaller conference, because sometimes you find out come tournament time that, you know, maybe their strength of schedule wasn't great during the season, and maybe Purdue's was, but maybe all the teams Purdue played were overrated. Right. And so Florida Atlantic, that's a team that these are the numbers I got on them. We got 37.2% from three. They're, you know, pretty average from three in free throw, 71.6%. They're averaging 6.8 steals per game, which I mentioned to Adrian that I feel like steals and 3-point shooting are such a big part of March in these upsets. You see a lot of turnovers forced for these teams that pull the upsets, and they tend to get hot from three. So I like seeing teams with those upsides, and Florida Atlantic's one of those.
Let me ask you something. You know, I think the conventional wisdom has always been that the way Cinderella operates is you got to have good guard play. That the NCAA tournament was set up for, you know, usually you got a couple of senior guards. They're probably undersized, and that's why they're at a lower level school. But they got a ton of experience, and you just reeled off a couple of guard statistics in general, right?
Yep.
3-point shooting,
yep.
Steals.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I said, we're, you know, with Adrian, my goal is to try to, you know, look at these teams that are pulling upsets and see kind of what the common denominators are. And I do think that, you know, they're kind of guard heavy. I mean, FDU was the smallest team, I think, in tournament history in terms of height, and they were playing up against a team with a 7-footer. Which, by the way, I'm going to try to get numbers on this for next week. Teams that are offensively centered around a 7-foot, like kind of traditional big man, do they ever make it like to the Elite Eight? Or it seems like, and I mean, unfortunately, Mike, I think this hits a little too close to home for you. I believe was Kofi Cockburn. Is he a 7-foot guy?
No, I mean it's a fascinating thing in all of basketball, right? Because when you know, look and. There's no great insights here. When I grew up, that was the top of every draft, right? It was the 7-foot, 7-foot-1 kind of wide body. Kofi Cockburn for Illinois had all sorts of collegiate accolades, right? And he was in some ways unguardable at the college level because he was bigger than everyone else, but very little sort of love from the professional side. Doug, I can't think of a I mean, I guess Joel Embiid ends up being sort of the most traditional kind of guy that still has a lot of, you know, the guy, and I'm not saying that he does, but in terms of resembling that, I mean, it's a good observation in terms of how the three-point shooting has completely changed the game of basketball.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned Embiid. You look at the NBA, and it's more or less the same story. Maybe not to the same extent. Like, I feel like there's more upsets in the first round. College basketball teams that have seven-footers or that are centered around seven-footers than in the NBA. But you look at the MVP race right now. I mean, Nikola Jokic, Joel Embiid, and those guys have been MVP candidates for the last couple of years. But come playoff time, nobody's picking them. You know, last year it's the Warriors. You know, teams like the Suns are going to be hot picks, no pun intended. Teams like the Celtics, teams that have dominant guard play. And it seems, for whatever reason, it's much like quarterback play in the NFL, Mike, where, you know, the 49ers with Jimmy G in any given year could have won 13, 14 games in the regular season, but come postseason, no one's expecting them to make it even, you know, to the Super Bowl. And I think that's the expectation with a guy like Jokic in Denver and a guy like Joel Embiid. And I'd love, personally, I'd love to see a finals this year of Sixers Nuggets, two all-time greats, bigs, but we just haven't seen that, Mike. And college basketball, we haven't seen as well. I was trying to think of like the last dominant big to really carry a team far into the tournament. And the last player I could think of was Anthony Davis.
Wow.
Who's really like a stretch four. I mean, he's kind of a hybrid. He's not a true center in the same way that a Joel Embiid or...
Well, he was... look, I remember him coming out of high school because yeah. he was well below the radar. I think he might have been ranked as something like a 3-star. And it was one of these early season camps or AAU events. And he rocketed up from maybe being a borderline top 100 player to, well, and the reason I know this story, remember this story, is because he played high school basketball in the state of Illinois, which means he was the University of Illinois, the target. But over the course of like one weekend, he went to a seemingly completely out of reach for the beloved Illini and, you know, kind of Kentucky bound. And, you know, again, I think he went from maybe out of the 100 to top one or top two players in the country. Interesting.
That's one of my observations. Another observation from Adrian, Fanalytics analyst, Fanalyst Adrian. In terms of offense, Florida Atlantic is very balanced scoring across their top five players: 13.9 points per game, 13.1 points per game, 10.4 points per game, 8.9 points per game, and 8.4 points per game. And one of my observations over the years is, my tendency when I'm doing my bracket is to look for like a Stephen Curry, look for a guy that can get really hot and that can single-handedly carry his team far into the playoffs. But it seems like more often than not, these teams that are pulling the upsets are really well balanced. And there's not, you know, they have a number of different weapons that can score the basketball, where a great team can't just focus on one player and try to shut him down. And if they shut him down, it's game over. Instead, it's a team that moves the ball around and is pretty balanced. And so that's another Florida Atlantic observation I made. But again, that, you know, to me, they're kind of borderline Cinderella. Like, that's a 30-win team in the regular season. We've seen those 30-win teams over the years make runs. Princeton, on the other hand, is a true, you know, the definition of a Cinderella, making it to the Sweet 16 as a 15 seed. And they've got a game against Creighton coming up, Mike, that, you know, feels winnable. It feels like they can make the Elite Eight.
Did you see the Instagram video? And I want to say this was a Bleacher Report video, so I think it's been all over, where they just had a camera going over the Princeton. And I don't know, you know, I'm not there cherry picking, but it was essentially, look at the students on the Princeton campus, and they're just sitting there at the library studying.
Oh, no.
You know, just zero emotion, right?
I love it.
The opposite of, you know, the Philadelphia, let's go out and flip a car kind of thing, win or lose.
I love it. The Princeton students are locked in. I think there are probably more Princeton basketball fans that didn't go to Princeton or have any affiliation with the school right now than people who actually went or are going to school. I think if you're going to school there, you probably don't have time to watch these games due to studies or whatnot. And so hats off to those students, but also hats off to those players. This is a team, Mike, during the regular season, 64th in offensive efficiency, 77th in defensive efficiency. Okay, so unlike Florida Atlantic, who was 13th and 18th respectively in those categories, this is not a team that has been performing at that level, and it's just a matter of how well the quality of their opponents. This is a team that is hardly in the tournament and performing ridiculously well right now. Another team that I feel like is well balanced. They're a high scoring team. They force a fair amount of steals. They have a pretty healthy free throw and 3-point percentage. Like, Princeton's kind of the classic underdog team in March. And again, Creighton coming up on the horizon. It's, you know, in March, I don't have a dog in the fight. Like, Georgia's not in the mix. Virginia's kind of my family's team, and they have a tendency to lose early as they did this year, which I predicted. But Princeton is my team moving forward. I will be riding with the Princeton team more than their students are the rest of the way.
Are you searching for the mascot, the Princeton Tigers, Doug, I believe?
The Princeton team is what I came up with.
Like, I mean, you know, it is... I mean, when I think Ivy League basketball, you know, obviously I think, you know, Penn's probably the historical power, but Princeton might be. I think it's always one of those two. To be honest with you, like, look, when I think about this tournament, 100%, right? It's like this idea of the underdog, Farley Dickinson beating, you know, 16 beating one. I think I've been a little bit of a pessimist the last few years in terms of
you,
in terms of where fandom is going. But, you know, the numbers have started to go up on some things. You know, from the tournament numbers, the TV ratings are up a little bit. The Emmy ratings were up a little bit. It's almost like the national mood might be shifting some. I'm absolutely fascinated that the tournament numbers were up, because I've heard so little chatter about college basketball this year.
Yep.
Guess what? It turns out it doesn't matter. No one knows any of the players. The focus is on, you know, some of the coaches, you know, Tom Izzo, and it's on the brands. You know, it's, well, Princeton and, you know, Princeton and Michigan State, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, that's all people need to know to sort of get back into this. So it's tremendous stories, always, always. And now, that being said, and this is where I started this from, I can't do it, Doug. I can't root for an Ivy League team. There's something too public school about me that, and again, people laugh. I used to say that kind of stuff. It's like, you know, I got degrees from Chicago and Northwestern as well, but I cannot root for the Ivy League team.
Well, I think part of that is being a professor at the Ivy League of the South, Mike. And it feels like we're underrepresented. We need Emory to have a D1 program, because, I mean, imagine the buzz in Atlanta if Emory were making this run, which, by the way, Kennesaw State almost pulled it off in the first round. They were this close to being the talk of the tournament.
Okay, Doug. So Kennesaw State is part of the state universities of Georgia. You know, Georgia has, of course, the University of Georgia, Georgia Tech, but KSU, and there's Georgia State. There's been some movement from the, let's say, the non-traditional powers to move into the highest ranks of collegiate sports. Kennesaw State made the NCAA tournament. We're leading Xavier well into the second half. Kennesaw State is also planning to go to the FBS division of college football. And so they're actually in the process of expanding the stadium so they can get their 15,000 people, you know, for their average attendance.
Right.
I don't know that did a lot for Kennesaw State in the long term, but I know that people at KSU were paying attention. There was even a bus that went up there from KSU. Mm-hmm. And so, again, what a great illustration of what this tournament means beyond just a basketball game. Suddenly, Kennesaw State is on the TV. And, you know, maybe doing it once is kind of a nice story. But if, you know, if they do that year after year after year, people know who they are.
Yeah, and you know, they're on millions of brackets and teams. Yeah, I had to research their team and their program and look into what they've accomplished and what their mascot is and all the rest. And so I think it's great. And
hold on. Hootie hoo. Go Owls.
Go Owls. Big Owls. Yeah, maybe next year for the Owls. But yeah, I think for those schools too, for the student body, just not, I know in the South, there's kind of, there's the students that get the, what they view as the traditional college experience, which is SEC football, right? In the South, again, that's viewed as the traditional college experience. And then there's the students that take another path. And I think for them to get to be front and center, limelight, like get to get all rambunctious on TV and celebrate and get all into it and get the full sports experience as part of their college experience is a great thing for those students. It's a great thing for the schools, attracting students and you know, putting the school on the map. So I think nobody put their school on the map more than Farley Dickinson. I remember when it was Florida Gulf Coast making a run in the tournament and looking in, and apparently their school was like on the beach and becoming interested. Now I know people who go to school there. And so I do think that there is the March Madness, particularly for these smaller under the radar schools, has this magic of putting them on the map and bringing them to the limelight, if only for a moment.
Okay, Doug, I got one more question for you. Who's your coach of the tournament so far?
Oh man, Mike, you know who I'm going to go with, and it's it is the head coach of Arkansas basketball. I don't know if you saw this, Mike, but during the game or after the game, Arkansas won a thriller, right, in their last game and against Kansas. And so I was watching with a buddy, and he and I watch March Madness together every year. We played high school basketball together. We've stayed in touch over the years, and like we never hang out until this time of year, and then we hang out. And every game we've watched, I swear, we've watched like five games, and the point differential across the five is probably 5 points. And so inevitably, when we watched the Kansas-Arkansas game together, it was going to be a classic, and it did not disappoint. Comes down to the end, Arkansas, it felt like Kansas was winning the whole game. Arkansas just stays in there. And my buddy kept saying, you know, inevitably Kansas is going to win this. I said, hey, it's a one possession game. Anything can happen. If you keep it a one possession game, anything can happen. Arkansas pulls the upset, and there goes the coach. He pulled a Pat Bev. I don't know if you remember Pat Bev when, I guess it was a play-in game or when the Timberwolves made the playoffs last year, he jumped up on the scores table and he took off his jersey and he just had on a wife beater. Well, Eric Musselman, great name, by the way, Musselman. Eric Musselman showed off his muscles, takes off the shirt, swinging it around. There was a fan in the crowd that was following his lead. I wanted to see the whole team follow his lead. I wanted everyone up on the table swinging their shirts around, starting a new Arkansas basketball tradition. But he was leading the Woo Pig Suey cheer. He was, and to me, it doesn't get better than that. And so that's my coach of the tournament thus far, leading a, you know, kind of middle of the pack SEC team into the Sweet 16 in the same tournament where Kentucky's out, Auburn's out, you know, a lot of these powerhouses in the SEC are out, and Alabama looking phenomenal, but Arkansas making it just as far to this point and celebrating right. I think that one of the most fun parts of March Madness, and Mike, you talked about it being all about the coaches, is that these guys, they let loose and have fun. Like in college football, I don't know if you notice how different it is when like Kirby Smart wins a first round game against TCU and they interview him and it's like, job's not finished. You know, it's that Kobe Bryant quote, job's not finished. Nick Saban, all those, you know, Ryan Day's that way. I mean, all the top coaches in college football, they have that, you know, we're not celebrating anything until we have a championship, and then we're celebrating for 24 hours and starting to prep for the next season. College basketball, these guys know how to enjoy the moment. They know when it's their time. Even like Tom Izzo is a guy who's had so much tournament success. You wouldn't think a second round game would mean anything to him. And he's partying like he just won the final, you know, like he won the whole thing. And so I love it. But Eric Musselman, my coach of the first two rounds, I'll be watching Arkansas in hopes that they get another win. And he continues with his new tradition of going full Magic Mike on the Arkansas fans on the front row.
Yeah. I mean, you wonder where it came from. Whether it was just a moment of pure inspiration or if he's got a history of it, but 100% it works, right? It's like, because it's like one of those moments of, and you just think through this, it's like you have this, you know, amazing athletic achievement. Everyone's emotions are heightened. Everyone's got full attention. And suddenly, you know, 40 plus 50 year old coach, I don't know how old he is taking off his shirt and swinging. 58 and throwing that shirt into the crowd. It's like, you wouldn't even script that, right? And so that's the beautiful thing. You mentioned Izzo, and you know, there's just tradition of these coaches, you know, dancing in the locker room, getting champagne poured on them. And you're right. It's it does seem to have a different feel than it does in the in big time college football, where maybe there's some Gatorade, but beyond that, we go straight back to business.
Back to business. And there's, it's kind of like people call the NFL the no fun league, but college football has gotten that way. And I love college football. Don't get me wrong, but I'm just saying the coaches and the players don't take themselves too seriously in college basketball. I remember Shaka Smart diving on the floor before games with players back when he was coaching at VCU. And, you know, we see it time and time again. I remember Roy Williams dancing, and, you know, it goes back to like, I mean, Ted Lasso's out now, and season one of Ted Lasso, they had that fake viral video of Jason Sudeikis dancing in the locker room with his football players. And, you know, it's like we've got a bunch of Ted Lassos coaching college basketball. Like, these guys know how to have fun. They know how to enjoy a win. And if they don't win it all, they're proud of their guys. And I mean, I saw some viral videos of coaches giving heartwarming speeches after a loss, talking about how proud they were of how hard their guys fought. And, I just love it. I love the culture, the coaching culture come March in basketball. And it's something unique to the sport and something special that you don't see in the NBA. And part of why a lot of people prefer college to the NBA, even though the NBA is a superior product in terms of performance of the players.
Doug, you know, it's obvious in your voice. You're totally all in on this. Did you watch a lot of college basketball this year?
No. I'm not going to pretend to. No.
Okay, I used to watch a ton of college basketball, and it seemed like it was almost, you know, almost hard to find this year. Like, it had really dropped off the radar. But it is remarkable how, you know, again, March starts. And look, I may have made a comment that, you know, even Selection Sunday didn't seem to have, or maybe, you know, sometimes I get confused between the podcast and class. You know, Selection Sunday, I mean, here's an analytics story. Selection Sunday used to be kind of a big deal. It was like, because no one knew who was going to get in. Now there are so many analysts and there's so much discussion of what the committee's looking for that there is essentially no mystery, right? It's like, oh, you know, we thought we were going to be an 8 and it turned out we were a 9. And so they've killed off a little bit of the magic associated with that. But, you know, so no marquee players, no household names on the court. Some of the dramatic buildup gone. But still, the nature of this tournament just works. And I think that's a great thing. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out over the course of, and sort of one of the problems is see how this plays out over the course of years and years. You know, can you sustain this, or will it evolve to something different?
Yeah, I think with college basketball in terms of fandom, during the season, it's a very localized, it's kind of like the MLB, like the people in those cities of the teams that are succeeding are following it real closely. And maybe there's, you know, the Dodgers equivalent would be like UNC or Duke. Like there's a couple teams with fans all over the place, but it's mostly localized. You know, like the Alabama fans I know were locked in this year. They were watching every game because it's Alabama's year. They have a great team. They have a great team. Of course, center of a lot of controversy, so they were kind of in the national spotlight as well. But mostly the people watching those games are Alabama fans. The Georgia fans I know, not watching a lot of basketball. You know, the non-basketball schools, if you will, they're fans. And I think the general public, it's like if you didn't go to one of those schools that's kind of at the top during the regular season, it's not that interesting or intriguing. But come March, all of a sudden, it's like everybody's pulling for Princeton. Everyone's was pulling for Farley Dickinson, or now, you know, Florida Atlantic. Like, March has this kind of built-in infrastructure of it doesn't matter if you have a team, because you have a dog in the fight if you have a bracket. And then they tell the stories so well and they're so compelling that everyone buys into the story of this team, this program of, you know, Farley Dickinson, a team that shouldn't have been in the tournament. They lost their conference championship to a team that wasn't eligible due to not being in the NCAA long enough, Division I. And the stories draw people in. It's like watching a movie in real time, Mike. And I think that it does engage a much wider audience than the regular season, because you still have those diehard Alabama fans, you still have those diehard Houston fans, those teams that are making runs as fans have been watching all year. But then you bring in people who don't have a dog in the fight, who have never had a team, who maybe didn't go to college or didn't go to a basketball school or a school that has D1 sports, and they're watching these games like their life depends on it. And so I love that about March. I think it's fun. I think it's almost a universal, I think it's almost a unifier in this day and age where we talk about the Super Bowl kind of being the one sporting event that brings everyone together. March is probably the closest thing I see, well, mostly due to the brackets.
Yeah, I think you're probably right that it probably is the brackets. I suspect that fantasy football has surpassed the brackets, but I would guess the brackets are the second biggest mass gambling. Mm-hmm. And again, call it gambling, call it fantasy, whatever you want to call it. But the brackets are probably the second most common thing that people participate in. And you know what? I could be wrong on that. I mean, the brackets were always like built for the office, built for the workplace, built for school, right? It's like, well, what are we going to do in March? Well, we're going to fill out the brackets and someone's going to score that. Then this went to, automated and ESPN, and suddenly, everyone's taking part. Your grandma's in the bracket, right? And, so it'd be an interesting thing. And I don't have a sense of what the data looks like, but in terms of, let's say, families doing things together, brackets and fantasy football, it's like one of those, what's that TV show where they have the Family Feud? Families do together, and fantasy football, it might be number three and brackets might be number four, right? After Zooming grandma for her birthday.
Yeah. And inevitably in the family bracket, the sports buff is the guy who has the worst ranking one, and the person in the group who wasn't a sports fan in picks based on the prettiest jerseys is going to be the person who comes out on top and gets the bragging rights. So that's part of the fun is, it doesn't have that barrier of entry of expertise. I think people feel intimidated with things like fantasy football or like, I don't know these players. I don't know. And March Madness, it is so random. It's not random, but it is random. There's that level of randomness where it gives everyone a chance and who knows what's going to happen. I've had my share of bottom ranking brackets in years where I have watched a lot of college basketball.
Yeah, but Doug, I think that's the thing about fantasy football and the brackets that actually makes it work, right? Because you're actually, the more expertise you think you have, you're probably more of a danger to yourself.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Where the non-fan who's just looking at the published rankings in terms of historical scores or looking at, this team's a one and this team's a 16. the experts will inevitably talk themselves into a worse finish than they need to.
Yeah. My problem every year is every year it seems like there's like three or four really massive upsets in the first round. And so I tend to pick three or four, like I'm trying to get it exactly right. And the problem is when you pick, when you get one of those, but the other three aren't right, but then three other ones happen and all of a sudden you just lost four games that you could have had at least three of them if you just pick the higher seed every time. So it does kind of come back to bite you if you overanalyze it. So we had an upset, Mike, in college wrestling this week that was bigger than any of the upsets in college basketball, including Farley Dickinson. And it had an all-time response. I mean, I expect a lot from fans in college basketball. This was next level, Mike. I had no idea.
I know what you're talking about, Doug, and you'll put the video out there.
Yeah.
Yes, this was... This was something that belongs in a college course on emotions. Mm-hmm. So the way this went down is the wrestler was a three-time defending NCAA champion.
Heavily, like the best of all time.
Yeah. And lost, and mom couldn't handle it. And so
Full temper tantrum.
But destroyed her glasses, which is, I think that's kind of the key thing. It's like, she destroyed her own glasses, right?
I'd love to see her get an NIL deal. That would be marketing magic. Get her with Lenscraft.
Orby Parker,
Lenscraft. Put her, show the clip, and then have her as the face of the company moving forward. I would love that. That was all time. And
isn't that the thing, right? When your team and what's great about it, right, is everyone can relate to it.
Yeah.
I mean, your kid losing is, of course, next level. But frankly, it's not that different from your team losing, depending on who your team losing, right? It's like,
I think, you know, a lot of us felt that way over the weekend. I know my family did, watching the Virginia game. Mike, from our previous conversation, sounds like you had those. You might not have behaved that way, but internally, that's exactly how you feel watching your team.
So what Doug is referencing is the Fighting Illini lost in the first round to Doug's coach of the tournament so far. And I have to admit that I go in cycles, right? And now we've been doing this. Doug has been on the podcast for 3 years, and so he's actually seen a little bit of the cycles, because Illinois sports has struggled. But then we had a moment, and I think we were a number one or a number two seed one of the years into the tournament. And I came into this tournament talking trash and just rolling through. And we had my favorite player, Curbelo, and Kofi Cockburn, and blah, and I loved it. And then I remember infamously essentially coming on and I think talking trash about Sister Jean, because Loyola was the team that knocked him out, right? And so 100%, I'm talking trash about a nun. I think that's I'm a professor talking trash about a nun. That's the equivalent of me destroying my own glasses, I think.
Right. We've all done it. There's videos of me at Georgia games over the years, back in my days where I would paint up. I would always try to hide from the cameras in disappointing moments because I didn't want to become a meme. Some people did. And you see it all the time. One of my favorites all the time is, there's a Virginia fan after they blew a football game, and he throws his entire body over. He's on the front row, kind of in the end zone. He throws his entire body where he's just hanging like a rag doll. His arms are just hanging there. Just completely lost his will to stand up straight and have, you know, muscles or spine or anything. He just turned into jello as soon as they lost. It just totally broke him. And I love seeing that. But yeah, this mom, I don't know, something about parenting and sports. Like, anyone who played Little League sports or has been a parent for a child at Little League sports has seen a parent or two who loses their composure and maybe becomes over invested. I'm not saying this lady was over invested. Her son's in the national championship. It's a very big deal. And I actually admire her, the amount of commitment she had to seeing him through to win, and her inability to handle it appropriately when he didn't. And the people around her, it's like they're consoling her, like as if it looked as if she were grieving something serious, and they were legitimately concerned for her.
Well, and you know, the other great thing was sometimes you read the Twitter threads on these things, and yeah, and the path that one went that was struck me was, who cares? It's wrestling. After college wrestling's over, these things go on to nowhere. And then the quick responses of, or they could fight in the UFC or Bellator and make millions of dollars, blah, blah, blah. It's, and again, maybe that's almost a little bit, it's clearly it's a little bit different, but what we're talking about, but it's fascinating to see how these arguments play out, you know, how the reaction to this kind of, I mean, you know, when I think about what she did, right? Clearly, it's a little bit unhinged is the word that comes to mind, right? It's like she's kind of lost it. But Doug, I also couldn't stop but thinking, he's probably a national champion three times over because his mom had the right sort of crazy.
Oh, yeah. And to piggyback on that, and I'm glad you said that, Mike, the right sort of crazy. I don't know if you saw this video, but another video went viral of the mom and the son practice wrestling in the living room, and she pins him down, like just spit out his drink. I kid you not. I kid you not. There is a video out there, and she is if he's the national champion, she's probably runner up. So I think she's upset now that she just went from number two wrestler in the world to number three, because her son's now behind someone and her ranking fell as well. But that video is out there. I'll send it to you, Mike.
Thank you. Thank you.
but they were training in the living room since he was four for this. And so it's been a long time coming. And the only thing I like more is seeing parents react that way in Little League sporting events.
Okay. To finish off today, I want to let's continue our path through the quarterback narrative, sort of quick review in terms of what everything that went down over the last year. We are now at the AFC West. You know what, Doug? It's funny. When I started to think about the AFC West, you know, the one name that didn't even occur to me, I started thinking, Justin Herbert and, you know, Derek Carr and, you know, the Broncos. And I realized I had completely, and then I, you know, sort of just pulled it up and went, yeah, Mahomes. And but I realized why I had done it. You know, I like, one of the reasons I love talking about quarterbacks is because there's almost always this great debate of, you know, it's not, you know, it's not Peyton Manning, it's Tom Brady, it's not Terry Bradshaw, it's Kenny Stabler or Roger Staubach, right? There's always this kind of debate, and it could usually be had by some people throwing this number out or that number out. This last year, Pat Mahomes dominated just about every statistical category, Doug, and he won the Super Bowl, and the Chiefs went 14-3. It is as clear a domination of this is the guy. He also has the biggest long-term contract. So in some ways with Pat Mahomes, there's not a lot to say. The narrative continues. Brady's retired again. This guy is the next guy up, not just in terms of being the great quarterback. He's the next guy up in terms of being the face of the league. I don't know if he can do it in terms of personality, in terms of acting ability. But he is the next guy up in terms of like the guy that looks to be ready to dominate the league for the next decade.
Yeah, he does. And going into the season, there was that debate about Buffalo Bills quarterback, Josh Allen, and Patrick Mahomes, and whether or not Josh Allen was actually the better quarterback and would this year be the year. I know a lot of people think that Buffalo should have been in the Super Bowl last year. And so they felt like this year is going to be the year where Josh Allen proves. And I think part of that is like, I think people are a little biased to Josh Allen because he's like a little bit more likable personality, or I don't know. There's, you know, we've kind of touched on like Patrick Mahomes. Not everybody loves Patrick Mahomes. And it's not like he's a bad guy or anything, but he's so unorthodox, and everything about him is so unorthodox that I think it rubs some people the wrong way. And so I think there were kind of people rooting for Josh Allen to be that guy, to be the next Brady and to kind of supplant Mahomes as the face of the league this year. And it didn't happen, Mike. And it's all about the playoffs. And come playoff time, Kansas City dominated again. Patrick Mahomes, another MVP Super Bowl performance. You know, it's a team that went 14-3 in the regular season. I think the reason we don't think about them in reference to their division, the AFC West. When I think of the AFC West, I don't think of the Chiefs. Like, I start thinking about the other couple teams because it's like a given. The Chiefs are going to win it. And they're already, you know, they're, it's who's the second team going to be? Because the Chargers, are they going to make the playoffs? The Raiders, the Broncos? I mean, going into the season, people thought the Broncos could be that second team. And of course, they finished 5-12. And so, you know, it's like the Chiefs are kind of in a league of their own. It's the AFC West. And then there's the Kansas City Chiefs as the champions. And it's like, who's going to get the AFC West wildcard spot, if any of them?
Right.
Which this year was the Chargers.
And it might be the same thing at this point in terms of the quarterback debate, which is almost a little unfortunate. I love the idea of there being a quarterback debate, right? Of who is the guy. And so, you know, just no, this is not an absence of love for Patrick Mahomes. But I'd like to see, you know, Burrow step it up, or Josh Allen step it up, or Justin Herbert step it up.
Herbert.
That kind of controversy going.
I think a lot of people are kind of backing Burrow now. It's kind of like politics with these quarterbacks. Like, it's like when one guy loses a race, the next election, it's like, well, what about this other guy? And people start getting excited about another guy. And I think that Burrow's that other guy now. Josh Allen, still, like I've said 100 times, still in a great position. Bills are still in a great position. Nothing's changed. They're still a great football team with a great position to compete moving forward. But it's like people are starting to move on a little bit and say, well, maybe Burrow will be that. Maybe he'll be the guy that can supplant Mahomes. And Herbert's like one step behind Burrow.
And I hate to be, you know, I hate to use this kind of terminology because it just seems kind of like you're just lacking the right kind of analytics or vocabulary, but you know, it seems like Burrow has much more of the it factor, like the marketing factor, to be the face of the league. It's just, frankly, it's just more fun when Burrow is winning than when Mahomes is winning. But the next guy, you're right, Justin Herbert. You know, he is in that next group of quarterbacks, and he's I think coming off his third season. And so we should very quickly be understanding now what we've got in Justin Herbert. What we've seen so far is very good. You know, look, Doug, as an aside, part of me looks at some of the franchises these guys play for, Herbert and Burrow in particular, and you just wonder if those franchises are going to be able to provide the support structure for those guys to become the dominant quarterbacks in the NFL.
Yeah. I mean, Burrow's certainly in that position in Cincinnati, where it's like he inherited a really bad team. And I don't know if he had the support structure, but he took him to the Super Bowl, and now they're a competitive team every year. And the Chargers, you know, what's interesting about Justin Herbert, you talk about your Bill Belichick, not your Bill Parcells rules. The Parcells rules. I don't know if Herbert checked all those boxes. Like, he was a guy at Oregon, elite talent, great performances. I don't know that they won. I don't think they made the college football playoff. I don't know that they achieved as much as you would maybe expect with like a generational talent like that.
How many years did he start for him?
I think 3 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think they won a Rose Bowl in there, but not when it was a playoff game. And so he's a guy that, I mean, much like Josh Allen, I think until he wins a championship, the knock on him or the question about him, the hesitation about Justin Herbert is going to be, yeah, he puts up stats, but can he win the big one? You know, and that's always the question. And some guys get over that hump. I mean, I remember like as a Georgia guy, Kirby Smart, when he lost his first national championship, lost the SEC championship the next year, and he was kind of got pegged as, oh yeah, he wins a lot of games, but can't win the big one. And that was Peyton Manning for a long time. That was Dabo Sweeney, at Clemson, when Clemson was kind of the butt of a lot of jokes because they would never get over the hump, and Ohio State football for a while until that Ezekiel Elliott team. And so, you know, we've seen it over the years. Like, it's not like you can't get out of that, but Justin Herbert is in that stage, as is Josh Allen right now, where it's like, yeah, they're crazy good and they put up crazy numbers. But benefit of the doubt is going to go to Mahomes, even if his numbers aren't as good. They'd say they'd prefer him.
He's, Herbert was actually down a little bit in 22 versus 21.
Yeah.
You know, just looking at touchdowns to interceptions, he was 38 and 15 in 21, dipped down to 25 and 10 this last year.
Yeah.
Passing yards went from, I think it's 5,000 to about 4,700.
Was he hurt? Did he miss any time?
I don't recall. I mean,
I don't either.
Still passing for 4,700 yards. Doesn't seem like he missed much time. The odd thing about it though, Doug, he took a little bit of a step back, but the team improved by one game and went to 10-7 from 9-8. Now I'll be honest with you, like Justin Herbert, and this might seem like a strange connection. Justin Herbert's the guy that if I'm the Chargers, I'm really interested in what's happening with Lamar Jackson, right? Not that I have an interest in Lamar Jackson, but is Lamar Jackson going to reset the quarterback world and now suddenly we're going to go to $60 or $65 million a year? And so Herbert's interesting, right? Because there's still a couple of option years left for the Chargers. But like Burrow, you know, some of these really young guys, they may have to do something really crazy financially. Otherwise, you know, face a situation. If these quarterbacks all start going to the free market, then suddenly, you know, as Los Angeles Chargers franchise without a lot of history, without a lot of history of winning, you really got to think about locking this guy up before you've done any deep playoff runs at a couple of $100 million, $250 million guaranteed.
Yeah, I'd lock him up as soon as I could, Mike. Yeah. He's one, you know, we talk about, what's the best thing to do with Lamar Jackson. There's a lot of these situations. Should the Giants re-sign Daniel Jones, which they did? All these kind of tough situations, tough decisions about quarterbacks who you're not sure if it's the right move for the cost. I don't know if there's a cost that is too much for Justin Herbert when you're the Chargers. We know how hard it is to land a quarterback of that caliber. Likely not happening in free agency. And the drafters, you know, most years don't even have a quarterback of that caliber, much less like where you're positioned to draft them. And so for the Chargers, Justin Herbert's in a great position. I think the Chargers are in a great position in that they have him on the roster and that they can lock him down. And very similar to Cincinnati. Like I would do whatever it takes. I would go ahead and try to, you know, arrange that long-term deal, get it locked in and move forward from there, not deal with a potential fiasco, Drew Brees situation or Lamar Jackson situation where the guy has the opportunity to leave and go to another team. Potentially to a team that's better equipped for a Super Bowl.
Yeah, but now I think the question is, you know, depending on what happens with Lamar Jackson, are you even going to be able to lock these guys down?
Right? Is he going to just say, nope, I'm holding out?
I mean, if Jackson gets his $300 million or $275 million, then it could fundamentally change the dynamics of all this. So I agree with you. If I'm the Chargers or the Bengals, locking these guys down because these guys have shown enough.
Yeah. So Lamar Jackson, I mean, the perception is that he really rolled the dice on this. Like from a risk management standpoint, Lamar Jackson did not take a conservative approach. And I don't know that he has an agent representing him. I know that like Roquan Smith in a very similar situation left Chicago, was traded from Chicago to Baltimore because he wanted a contract that would reset the linebacker market. Chicago wasn't willing to pay it. He's representing himself. Also, kind of the perception was that he was being a little bit extreme, not managing his risk very well, and it might come back to bite him, particularly if there were to be an injury. Well, sure enough, Roquan Smith got the contract he wanted in Baltimore, and he's getting paid a lot more than he would have paid had he played it safe. Lamar Jackson, we'll see what happens, but he's in a very good place in the sense that he did not have a serious season-ending injury. Well, I guess he did have a season-ending injury because he didn't play at the end of the season. But
well, the only thing that I think the thing that complicates the Lamar Jackson move, right, is those two first-round picks. Right? Yeah. What would the market look like if you didn't have to give up two first-round picks? Because that takes his price from being historical to potentially crazy. It's probably why there seems to be very slow movement for Jackson so far. Doug, the third team in the AFC West. I love this division in some ways. Derek Carr. I mean, that was an odd ending to a career where essentially he kind of, you know, decided to shut it down, right? To park the car, to retire the car, as they would say in Formula One. But they've now gone with Jimmy G. And Doug, I'll tell you something that I'm fascinated by. It's a pretty significant discount to replace Derek Carr with Jimmy G. But in terms of the numbers I'm looking at, I'm feeling pretty good about that if I'm the Raiders. I think I may have almost gotten an upgrade for, you know, 67% of the price.
Yeah, and they got roasted on social media. There's, you know, replacing one guy with basically the same guy. And that's how sports fans view these things. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at it and you say, well, he's not any better. But if you think about it in terms of salary and what you can do with that money, like the opportunity cost, you take a guy like, would you rather have Derek Carr and his production or Derek Carr and an extra however many millions of dollars that can go toward the offensive line and the running backs and the receivers and the defense? And like, if you can get a guy of equivalent production and also have more resources toward building the team around them, it's a good move and it's a better team. And, you know, I don't hate the move for Oakland, and I think it was very calculated. And I don't know that they got a fair shake in the media for what they did and what they pulled off. And Jimmy Garoppolo has won a lot of football games over the years. He's played on good teams, but he's won a lot of football games.
Let me give you a couple numbers. So Derek Carr, his quarterback to interceptions, and I'm just using this as a shorthand, was 24 versus 14 in 2022 versus 23 and 14 in 2021. Mm-hmm. That's pretty consistent. And pretty consistent in terms of being a very average NFL quarterback. Mm-hmm. Jimmy G through 11 games was 16 touchdowns and 4 interceptions. Mm-hmm. And the year before he was 20 and 12. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm using this ratio as a shorthand. These are the same guy. There's mm-hmm. very little evidence to indicate that Derek Carr is a significant, and you know, people can throw out different stats. Look, I look at all these stats. There's not that much to go on that says Derek Carr is going to take you to a fundamentally different level, but it does seem to be still, and look, Carr took a little bit of a haircut on his, who did he sign with New Saints. Orleans.
Yep.
That, you know, he came down a little bit. He still got very good money. What did he get? $100 million guaranteed, where Garoppolo got $45 million guaranteed. So, you know, it's a significant discount. And not a significant drop off in terms of the observables.
Jimmy Garoppolo I think that the frustration from a fandom perspective is that when you make a change, you want it. Every fan base in the NFL wants to acquire the quarterback. They want Justin Herbert. You know, they want to bring in a guy. They're like, why would we replace one guy with another guy who's not going to get us any further? And I don't really expect them to make it further or much further. You know, I don't expect the Raiders to be winning Super Bowls with Jimmy G, to be honest. And at the end of the day, it's all about Super Bowls, and a lot of people are Super Bowl or bust. And so, but you know, if you're looking at it and saying we want to have a better situation, we want to improve, and we want to save some money and potentially better position ourselves to get that, you know, that next quarterback, this isn't a terrible move for the Raiders. And so it's neither here nor there. I think that you see it in the NBA all the time when like a team like Portland, who's kind of fringe playoff team, makes a move and acquires a guy, and it's like, well, this isn't going to get them over the hump and win them NBA championships, so what's the point? And I get that. Like, it is, all these moves kind of don't matter except for the ones that make that big change that, you know, gets you over the hump. But it's a long game for these GMs, and I think that, you know, the GM of the Raiders is slowly trying to improve in any way he can. In this situation, I think it's mostly about saving cap space, and I think that that does better position you to win Super Bowls down the road.
I like that, because there's a lot of truth to that notion, right? That when you're talking about, and let's say for the NFL, when you're talking about being in the territory of winning somewhere between 7 games and 9 games or 6 games and 9 games,
yeah,
in some ways, none of this matters to the fans, right? It's just a question of, well, we get a, you know, we get one more weekend of football, and we play a wild card game,
we lose versus, by 30.
We're a little bit upset because we're drafting from a position where we're missing out on the fourth best quarterback, right? It's it kind of spin in your wheel stuff. Okay, Doug, last place in this division, I think, was the Broncos and Russell Wilson. This was probably the biggest bust in the NFL last year, the biggest disappointment. There was some talk about the Denver had a Super Bowl roster, and Russell Wilson came in big money, 5-year, $242 million contract, and the wheels fell off.
Their offense was atrocious this year. I watched them on a number of occasions, and it was particularly painful in the red zone and low-scoring games, and they could not seem to figure anything out. I know they've made some changes. They're sticking with Russell Wilson, but guess what? I don't think that's by choice. If you look at his contract, the Denver Broncos are married to that man right now, much like Ciara. And I don't know that they're able to get out of that. And so contractually, you know, they've kind of got, with how much money he's being paid, they can't really afford to go after a Lamar Jackson or go with any other quarterback. And so they've got to retool and build around Russell Wilson. And I know some Denver Broncos fans, and they are a miserable bunch. They have had, ever since the Peyton Manning years, they have had some bad years and a lot of high hopes in those years. And so those two together.
Are they optimistic about bringing in a new coach to fix the, because I mean, the coach quarterback pair is something I talk about or think about.
I mean, Broncos fans I know are not over it. They think that, you know, it's they've seen coach changes. They've seen, you know, quarterback changes. It's like, we got to start over again, and we're stuck in this for the next 3 years or however long it is. And so not an optimistic bunch. But to your point, Mike, we've seen quarterbacks stay and coach changes make all the difference in the world. Look at Trevor Lawrence. And again, different situation than Russell Wilson, different point in his career. He was already on the rise. Russell Wilson may have already been on the decline, but we've seen that coach change be the difference in being a playoff team and being the number one pick in the draft, whether it's Cincinnati, Jacksonville. And so Denver fans, I think they've got to sell themselves on that coach and the fact that he's going to use Russ the right way, that they're going to click, that it's going to be a different year. And they got to look in the mirror and say, Denver Broncos, Broncos country, let's ride.
Okay, Doug, last thing. One of our favorite sports shows returned to the streaming services this week on Apple TV, Ted Lasso.
Into the White House.
Into the White House. We're one episode in. You know what? I'll give you my rating out of 10, and then we can talk about it. I'm pegging that one at a 6.5 out of 10. You know, I was really disappointed. I loved season one. I thought season one was one of the all-time great sports comedies, had you know, beautiful characters, a simple message, but it was really a lot of fun. I thought season two, they kind of started spiraling into a lot of plot lines that they didn't need to go down. This one seemed to bring it a little bit back to where they needed to be. But it wasn't to the point where I'm like, oh God, I'm all back in. I love this. I can hardly wait to see where they go next. It felt, and I'm going to, you know, I'll throw out a couple more lines and you tell me if I'm crazy. It almost feels like they think they got me. And now they've got these beloved characters and the audience should just watch to see what happens to these beloved characters. And I don't think they're there, right? It's not like, it's almost like they're doing it this, like kind of this last go around, this almost tribute to themselves. It feels like to me that, and I think this is officially the last thing, that this will be Ted Lasso's last year living in London and then, or wherever he lives in the UK. And then he'll return, you know, at the end of the story arc. I think they should still be working for it.
Yeah. I think that one of my observations over the years with television is that it is very difficult to maintain the magic of season one into seasons two and three and four, et cetera. And very few shows do that. I think Stranger Things is a great example of a show that does that, by the way. But sports shows, I cannot think of a single example of a show that I truly felt the second and third season had the same magic as the first. I think Friday Night Lights had one of the best first seasons ever in television history, much like Ted Lasso. And it really fell off to me. And with sports, it's like it becomes predictable. You and I were talking about our expectations for this season. I've had that conversation with a number of Ted Lasso fans who pretty much feel like they know where this is headed, where it's going, kind of looking at the arcs of the different characters and the teams and understanding, you know, it's a predictable story. And so at that point, it does become kind of a love letter to the characters. And I love the characters. I love Ted. You know, I love watching him on screen anytime. He's just such a, he makes you smile, and there is a level of entertainment to that. But does it have that same magic of season one? I don't think so. I think that conflict being resolved every season and then having to come up with new conflict, it gets where they stretch it. You're seeing the same thing in The Mandalorian. Like, the quest was finished, and then they found a new quest, and that one was semi-resolved. And then it's like this third season, they have to start this new quest, but it feels like, okay, they're just making up another conflict just to have a conflict. Like the lady in Ted Lasso, her season one and season two is kind of her coming to peace with things with her ex-husband, the former owner of the team. And now it's like they're introducing this new, well, she's actually not over it. And now she just wants revenge again. So she's kind of back to where she started. It's like, oh, one more Star Wars reference here. I know I make these every week, but the sequel films of 7, 8, and 9, I know it's confusing. So the new ones, the Disney movies, they undid 4, 5, and 6. And that's why all the fans hated it, but they have to. They're like, you can't, 6 is a happily ever after. And then you have to go and say, well, actually the guy that they worked 3 episodes to kill off comes back, and he's actually still alive and survived the whole thing. It was all part of his plan. So those movies didn't mean anything, but now we have conflict again and we still have our bad guy. And I feel like Ted Lasso is kind of doing that.
I'll throw out a couple of additional thoughts and you tell me what you think. So part of, I think, what it's become is the first season of Ted Lasso, you had some really kind of interesting interplay between players on the team. In particular, Roy Kent and yes. Jamie, whose last name escapes me. Jamie Tart. That was this grizzled veteran versus this kind of flamboyant kind of jackass of a player was beautiful. The players are now irrelevant to that show. I mean, they really don't play, you know, it's like now they've moved to the character level of, you know, was Danny Roja just sort of always kind of just smiling.
Just a nice guy. Yeah.
Just a nice guy. Nothing interesting happening in terms of what's going on in terms of the players. The other thing is, you know, you mentioned sort of the, you know, the original Rebecca, the owner, was originally sort of the bad guy, kind of just trying to destroy the team that Rupert loved. Now it seems like they're just setting it up for Rupert to be the bad guy.
Yep.
With maybe a redemption arc for the former kit man who's gone to work for Rupert. I don't hate Rupert, Doug. I don't hate Rupert at all. Rupert was a guy that loved something. His ex-wife took it from him. And so you're casting this guy as this villain. It's like, I mean you kind of get where I'm coming from, right?
No, I think the beauty of that first season is like we hated Jamie Tart. He was despicable. He was scum of the earth. And it was the same with like awesome, Stranger Things.
Right? But awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, but Stranger Things, like Steve Harrington character. I don't know if you've watched that, Mike, but Steve Harrington, season one, everyone hates the guy. Hate him. And spoiler alert, if you haven't watched these two shows, you can just like cover your ears. but Jamie Tart goes from the guy that you hate to a guy that you kind of like. Steve Harrington goes from a guy in Stranger Things that you totally hate to a guy that everyone totally adores and is like the most beloved character. And we had a little bit of that like kind of crazy redemption arc with Rebecca, the owner of the team, and of course with Jamie Tart. But everyone's arcs, that's what I'm saying, their arcs are resolved. Like she went from villain to kind of good to like she's moved on and is totally healthy, happy. Like her character story is pretty much over. And so they had to go back and say, actually, she's not totally happy. She's back to where she was in season one. And like, but Jamie Tart and Danny Rojas, who had a great, you know, he had a great little arc there and was a fan favorite. They've become totally one-dimensional because their issues are resolved. And now they're just set in this world of, it's like if Star Wars did those sequel movies and didn't go back and undo some of the things from the originals and say, yeah, Luke Skywalker's just a happy guy now and the galaxy's happy and everyone's happy and fun. And like there's little scuffs here or there, you know, little scuffles here or there. But as a whole, there's no real big conflict. And I think that's the problem with Lasso right now. And the fact that, like you said, I think the villain is so one-dimensional that he's kind of cartoony and he's harder to hate than Jamie Tart was, or even than Elizabeth, you know, than the Rebecca, excuse me, was, because she was a snake, man. In that first season, she was stabbing Coach Lasso in the back, and man, the kind of story of forgiveness that he had, and I mean, it really kind of touched people's hearts, I think. And I don't know that anyone's touched by a story about just a rich, mean guy who wants to win soccer games.
No. And in fact, at this point, I'm probably rooting for Rupert. But, you know,
you're going to be disappointed, Mike.
I know. Okay, guys, as always, thanks for listening. More content at www.fandomanalytics.com. Talk to you next week.